from Sounds True, Dr. Quantum presents A User's Guide to Your Universe, Session 9, Mind into Matter with Fred Allen Wolf.
Mind and matter. Matter and feelings. How do these things work together? Can mind literally change itself into matter? And once it's material, can those things we call matter change themselves into feeling? What am I talking about here? In this session, session 9, and then the one following this one, we're going to be looking at what I call a new alchemy. We're going to delve into the mystery of who and what we are in terms of something which borders on the very ancient view of the ancient alchemists and emerges into the new quantum physical view, which I call new alchemy. So what we're dealing with here is alchemy as a transformative process, something which merges, which assembles, which allows one to see the transformative process taking place. It's the emergence of the butterfly from the cocoon. It's that whole process which is the symbol of alchemy. In fact, when we get into alchemy, we're really looking at, if you will, the very beginnings of science itself. But when we actually go deeper into alchemy, we find that what the alchemists were trying to do as they were attempting to build a science is something that was different than the final goals that science emerged with. Science has emerged with the notion that everything is out there, and that what's out there independent of what's going on in here. That wasn't the way the alchemists saw it at all. The ancient alchemists were interested in changing the out there, but they knew a deep secret that once alchemy changed into chemistry and then into physics and all of that development got lost. And that thing that they saw is that what's happening in here and what's happening out there are much more intimately connected than we ever would have thought possible. In fact, that was the whole point of science, was to get rid of all that mystical mumbo-jumbo. I remember stories that I read about Johannes Kepler, who was the German astronomer royal and was one of the discoveries of what are called Kepler's laws, the laws which governed how the planets whirl about the sun. And what wasn't told about Kepler was that his mother was a witch, and he nearly spent all of the fortune or money that he earned as a royal astronomer in Germany to keep her from being burned at the stakes. So Kepler is on that borderline between what we call the old ancient alchemical view of nature and matter and physicality and mind and consciousness and spirituality and the new modern view, which is mostly materialistic, which is basically operational, which is basically mechanism, which is basically cause and effect, which is basically linear time. The ancient alchemical view was much different. It would say not only as above, so below. It would also say as within, so without. And it's these ways of seeing, these ancient alchemical ways of seeing, that got me thinking that if these ancient alchemists had actually studied quantum physics, they wouldn't have called it ancient alchemy. They would have probably called it new alchemy, because they would have seen how it was that their ancient shibboleths, their ancient belief structures, as above, so below, as within, so without, could actually lead to an actual science, which we call today quantum physics. So this is what we're going to be talking about in this first section, mind into matter. Now, when we talk about mind into matter, what are we really talking about? Well, let's begin. In the beginning was the Big Bang. I may have said that before, but remember what I told you about this Big Bang. It was matter, energy, space, and time, and consciousness coming into being at the moment that the Big Bang came into being. But what did it come into being from? You know, we're so used to thinking that there had to be a before if there was an after. And so what was there before the Big Bang? I mean, that's the big question. And scientists don't have any real answer because space, time, matter, and energy weren't there before there was a Big Bang. That, whatever that was, whatever we call it, I call it, you know, the imaginal realm or the realm of non-being. Whatever you want to call that realm would be what we might call today the void, the absolute voidness out of which everything comes into being. You might think of it also as the place of paradox, the place of impossibility, the place where something is alive and dead at exactly the same time, where something is right and left at exactly the same time, where something is believing in God and believing in the devil at exactly the same time, where something is an atheist and a deist at exactly the same time, where something is a man and a woman at exactly the same time. We're looking at a realm of impossibility, a realm of paradox. It is that realm which is at the heart of quantum physics itself, because what quantum physics deals with is the realm of possibilities and all possibilities, not just the goody good ones, but the baddie baddies as well. So this is where everything comes into being, this voidness. And I was looking to see, did those ancient alchemists have this idea? And when I dug really deep, I went back about 500, 600 years, and I looked at Germany, and I noticed something rather peculiar. Here are all these Christian alchemists. I don't know if they would call themselves Christian or not, but I think they would, because Christianity had pretty well overtaken Europe by this time. Martin Luther certainly had changed some of the basic shibboleths of Christianity, but nevertheless, Christianity was, I guess, the religion of Germany at that time. And I looked at what these ancient alchemists were dealing with, and they were always dealing with Hebrew symbols. I thought, were these people Jews in disguise and something like that? Why would they be using Hebrew symbols? And then I realized that these people saw these Hebrew symbols, which were referenced to something called Kabbalah, as actual alchemical symbols. So they saw them alchemically. It wasn't a religious thing at all to them. It was just simply, what are symbols we can use to signify the things that we are working with in our theories of transformation? Now, you might wonder about alchemists. You know, you picture an alchemical laboratory as kind of a dirty place and a lot of fire and smelting and melting and smelting. Oh, God, you know, a stinky place, and keep the kids out because, you know, there's molten metal flying all the place. And every once in a while, you see a king's messenger running into the laboratory saying, "We want more gold! We want more gold!" And, you know, that the guy's, "All right, wait, I'll get it. And the poor alchemist, he doesn't really want to change lead into gold. You think that's what he was all? He was interested in transformation of the internal, not the external. He was just doing that to keep alive. I mean, you know, a lot of people today that drive cabs in order to support their habits, whatever they happen to be. These alchemists were no different. They had to do what they had to do in order to keep alive. And that was, for the king, more gold, more gold, more gold. And for themselves, the secrets of transformation, the mystical underlying, the underpinning, which made all that even possible. Now, one thing I need to point out to you about these symbols, these Hebrew letters, you know, A is spelled A, B is spelled B, C is spelled C. In English, letters are letters. But in the Hebrew, Aleph, which is a letter, is also a word, and it's spelled Aleph Lamed Fei. And Beit, which is the second letter, is also a word. In fact, all of the Hebrew letters are words. But there's even more here. Every letter is also a number. Aleph is a number one. Beit is a number two. Gimel is a number three. Dalet is a number four, and so forth. And when we spell out each letter, we see that each letter is a combination of numbers. So the numerical as well as the literal significance of each letter word is important. And I'll be using some of that as we go on to explain how this all fits into the transformation of mind into matter and matter into feeling. So they were using these Hebrew symbols almost universally. I didn't find one of them that didn't recognize these symbols and use them. And the first symbol that they recognized was the symbol for the Hebrew letter A, which is pronounced Aleph, and it was the symbol of the void, that which comes into being from that which is without any being at all. Then I looked for the second symbol that they use, and the second symbol they use was the Hebrew letter Bet. And Bet is an interesting symbol because it represented not only the Aleph from which it came, so to speak, but it represented an action. This was the first action symbol. And what it did, when I first thought about it, I didn't quite get, but then I finally got to see what it was talking about. It represented limitation. It represented negation. It represented the action of stopping. It represented the action of setting a limit for something. It represents the containment of something. In fact, the Hebrew letter Bet, which is also a word, by the way, means house or container. And therefore, when you, for example, go to a Jewish temple, most of them, the first letter which denotes the name of the temple is Bet something. And it means house of. There's a temple in San Francisco near where I live called Beit Shalom, the house of peace. So house of or Beit represents that which contains peace. So you see, the Hebrew letter is Kabbalistic in the sense of what it does. It limits. It says inside of this there's going to be peace. Outside, we don't care. We're not interested. That goes back to the Aleph again. What we're only interested in finding here is what's contained within. So I began to look even carefully at what that all meant. And it came to me that even words were baits. Words are things that we create to limit our experience of the outside world. And after all, I say cat. A French person says cha. A German person says katze. And we all are signifying the same thing, but they're not really the same word at all. They may look alike, but they're really different words. And these are limitations. In fact, even though they signify the same thing, and maybe we all see cats the same way, I'm not really sure if a French cat behaves like a German cat or like a Russian cat or like an American cat. Depends on how they're treated, I guess. But whatever they signify the particular structural way of signifying that animal for that particular language group. But Bet itself has them all. It is simply the symbolic act of limitation, creation. So all words are Bet. Bet also refers to something in quantum physics. It refers to the action of awareness. Because out of the Aleph, which is all possibilities, Bet limits and produces a limited set of possibilities. And that is what looks like to me the action of consciousness. So then I began looking at the third symbol. And the third symbol was Gimel. And that is the Hebrew letter G. Bet, by the way, was the Hebrew letter B. And they use the Greek form of the alphabet, alpha, beta, gamma, aleph, bet, gimel. By the way, alpha, beta, gamma comes from the Hebrew. I believe the Greek was derived from the Hebrew. At any rate, we have G, gimel, and gimel in Hebrew means camel. And what it signified was movement, movement. Now, there's a whole bunch of stuff that comes out when you begin to study these letters in this kind of alchemical or Kabbalistic manner, and it has direct reference to what we mean by quantum physics. And now the movement that was being referred to here was something that would come into being as a result of an action of Bet. In other words, when Bet limited, it didn't just stop all action. a new action would ensue. New possibilities would arise. New things would start to flow. That's what these alchemical findings were showing me. And what I was beginning to reconstruct in the game of mind into matter was how to look at that from a mystical alchemical point of view. So far we've seen Aleph, Beit, Gimel. We've seen spirit transforming into limitation, which gives rise to new possibilities. Now, the fourth symbol is one of the most important. And usually when I give talks about this, I usually stop at the first four because it's enough just to grasp what these first four symbols mean. The fourth symbol is Dalet, which is D or Delta. Delta, Dalet. You can see how similar the Hebrew and the Greek are. Delta is the Greek, Dalet is the Hebrew. Dalet represented a door. What does that mean? It represents a way in which something gets through, but something doesn't get through. It represents something which can be open and something which can be closed. It's not just an act of containment, as Beit is. It's something which kind of nudges, kind of resists. And that is what it does. It's the symbol of resistance. And what surprised me is that these ancient alchemists, the ancient Kabbalists, recognized that resistance was a natural part of the world. Most of us probably, in our dreams and our fantasies and our myths and our hopes and our desires, would love it if nobody resisted us as we made our way through life. You inch up to that girl next to you and you say, "Hi, babe, I really like you." And she says, "Get off, bub." And you say, "Oh, God, resistance. Why can't you just like me as I am?" And you know, that kind of stuff. Resistance is vital. What is it for? Why is there any resistance? Well, I'll give you an alchemical clue here, a mind into matter clue here. Think of an egg. Okay, I got it. I got an egg. And I usually open it up to have my breakfast. Oh, well, no. I don't want you to do that. Just think of the egg and think of the life that's contained within the egg. Because inside of that egg is a living being, a chick, and maybe just a few cells of chick, which is developing and growing and transforming. And would any of that be possible if there was no resistance? For example, if the shell couldn't protect the egg, if there was no resistance from the outside world coming in to get that egg, that chick could never develop. So the resistance of the shell is vital. But yet, what does the chick have to do to finally get born? The chick has to peck through that shell, has to break the resistance. So you see, resistance is vital. Resistance is symbolic. And it also leads to something else. Something which is equally mysterious to physics, but something very necessary for us to have this experience we're having right now. See, right now, you don't think you're having a mystical experience. You're wrong. You are. This experience that you're having at this particular moment is mystical, it's transcendent, it's far out, and it's happening in the realm that you have forgotten or maybe are aware of. But nevertheless, it's where you are. It's the timeless, spaceless realm of the Aleph. But what you're dealing with is resistance. What's the most obvious resistance you're dealing with right now? The answer is your body. Your body resists. Your body has what we call inertia. In fact, the whole physical world wouldn't be a physical world without this property we call inertia. We measure inertia. We give a name to it. We call it mass. And from Einstein, we know mass and energy, E equal mc squared, same stuff. So therefore, energy also has inertia. So inertia is it's that which makes physicality physicality. Because I want to tell you something, Matilda. When you leave this planet, when you leave this life, there ain't no resistance to deal with anymore. Except what's in your head, what you make up, because then you're in the realm of the Aleph, the realm of the spirit, if you will. And there's no matter to play with. And in fact, that's what life is really all about. You get into a body in order to have the experience of moving and shaping. You get to be a creative element. You get to be a co-creator in this whole science we call, or this whole life we call, whatever we call, science, life, mystery, magic, wonderful, hateful, however we want to label it. And now we come to the fifth symbol of mind into matter. And it is He. It's like the letter H. And it's pronounced like Hey. There's a breath coming out. In fact, it's a symbol of that breath. And it's a symbol of what's meant by breath. It's a symbol of life itself. It's very simple. Some Kabbalists spell it with two letters. Some of the Kabbalists that I have worked with tell me it's only spelled with one letter. Hey, one letter. It is life in itself. It is the symbol of life in itself. And all of the first four have led very naturally into life. So that when spirit limits producing new possibilities and turns them, gets them moving, and then they meet up with resistance, we have created life. We're talking Frankenstein monster, if you want to. We're talking the secret of life. It's that process which goes on. And if and when we begin to develop new forms of technology, which I call quantum computation, believe me when I tell you that some of these things I'm telling you right now are going to be the things we're going to be thinking about as we begin to look for true artificial intelligence. You know, right now we can create a robot which marches around the room. We even got robots that'll vacuum your floor for you. But they don't think when they're doing it. They have some sensing apparatus, certainly. So there's some of the stuff going on in these little robotic vacuum cleaners that run around, but they're not really alive. They're not really alive because they don't do the process that you can do, which is to bait things, to contain things, to limit things, and thereby to create new possibilities which come into being, and to deal with the resistances which come out. Because if these resistances didn't come out, didn't come up at all for you as you were dealing with them, then the whole process couldn't start over again. You couldn't begin forming new limits and having new possibilities arise. So novelty is part of this whole transformative process, and that's what this symbol of life is all about. It's at the balance. It's the fifth symbol. There are actually four more. The sixth one is called Vav, and it represents fertility. It represents a natural thing that life does. Life does more life. Life uses the first four symbols to go on to make more life. And the symbol for that is Vav. Vav is fertility. It's the endless production of seed. If you want to, there's a kind of a masculinity implied in Vav. Vav is like sperm cells. It just, whoosh, you got a lot of them out there. It's Vav, 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 all the way out. It is prodigious. It goes on and on and on. It's a symbol of, in a way, mindless activity, but nevertheless a part of life itself. So it also represents that which leads to the possibility of new life. The next thing we come to is number seven, which is the principle called Zain. That's like our letter Z. And it represents the possibilities, the probabilities that can arise as a result of the action of this endless fertility. And from that, we come to the A symbol, which is, what does it all mean? Meaning and manifestation are beginning to occur. Mind is changing into matter. Matter is beginning to materialize. See, all along, I've been using the metaphors of my language of physics to explain what these symbols mean. But these are archetypal symbols. These are at the level of within the realm of the imaginal, within the realm of the Aleph, within the realm of the void. These have not actually manifested yet. This whole first nine symbols that I'm talking about now are really archetypal. So here we have the eighth archetype, which is meaning, gathering together, looking at, the way it's pronounced is chit. It's not H-A-T-E, but double H-A-Y-T, chit, and or het sometimes. And it really also refers in some ways to life, like in the Hebrew word l'chaim, it's spelled with a chit. So we have here this whole structure arising, which is the structure of meaning. And finally, we come to the ninth symbol. And it's at the ninth symbol that we come to the end of the archetypes, of these ancient alchemical archetypes. And this ninth symbol represents structure and beauty, spirit and soul. And it's pronounced Tet, T-A-Y-T, Tet. And Tet is the beginning of the formation of a physical entity, namely a cell, a nucleus, a particle of matter, a structure which can persist and go on, something which has eternity almost built into it, the structure of the cellular tissues which make up our body. Now that's the first nine, the archetypal symbols. When you go to the next nine, which are the ramifications of these first nine symbols, into what are called the actual, the present, that which is in existence, we then are beginning to look at how mind just changed into matter. We begin to look at the next phase, which is how matter begins to transform into the living experience, which we call feeling. Now, I'll be talking about that a little later. Let me give you some examples of what I just went through kind of in an abstract way. I want to take you to the third symbol, the symbol which is movement, Gimel. Remember the camel? And tell you a little bit about how that works. The way it works is through a recognition of some ancient ideas. And let me tell you what those ideas are. In ancient Greece, the alchemists of that time, in working with this symbol of movement, the Gimel, recognized that everything was made of four elements. And if they could figure out how these four elements could be mixed and changed and transformed, they could see the science of movement taking place. They could see how something changes into something else, how the transformation would occur, how that movement from one thing to another could occur. So first they had to figure out what are the primary elements. Now in physics we know there are 92 primary elements, but in the ancient Greek mythology or the ancient Greek science at the time, there were only four, and I think you already know what they are. They're earth, fire, air, and water. And if you're sitting down and you have a piece of paper, you can draw a square and turn it up so that there is a corner at the top of the square and a corner at the bottom. So it really is like a diamond, okay? And at the top of the diamond, the top point of the diamond, write the word fire. And at the bottom point of the diamond, write the word water. And now you have the first reference frame of fire and water. Water and fire are opposites. They're like polar opposites. They're on the opposite sides of things. Water quenches fire. Fire turns water into steam, etc. So we know that these are polar opposites. Now let's go to the ones on the two points on the sides of the diamond. On the left side of the diamond, write the word earth. And on the right side of the diamond, write the word air. So now we have like a baseball diamond. In the center would be the pitcher. Home plate would be water. Second base would be fire. First base would be air. And third base would be earth. So earth and air are polar opposites to each other. Okay? So now let's look at what we can learn by seeing how combinations of these various elements would appear. How we would have an internal understanding, an eternal representation, an eternal sensation of, a knowledge of, how, something that would be subjective as a result of labeling these objective qualities. Well, first of all, let's look at what takes place between home plate, which is water, and first base, which is air, along that line. Well, if something is both water and air, what would it feel like? What would your sensations tell you it was? Well, water and air would feel moist. And you know what that's like. I live in San Francisco. You go out on a foggy day, and that's what moist feels like. Moist is air and water together. It's a cloud, okay? Now let's move from first base up to second base. Second base, remember, is fire. So now we have something which is going from air to fire, something which is air and fire. What would something feel like if it was air and fire? And the sensation you would have of air and fire is something you know, especially if you live in the desert or if you live in a high country, Mexico or in South America. It's called hot. You experience hot. So something which is air and fire together feels hot to the skin. In fact, that's what we do when we heat up air in your apartment building or in your home. That warm air, fire is going into the air and making the molecules of the air move around much, much, much faster. So in other words, each molecule has got a little fire into it. Each molecule of air has a little fire into it. So we have air and fire mixed together, and that we would call hot. Okay, now we're in second base at fire. Let's move down to third base. And as we go from fire to earth, what would fire and earth feel like? Well, if you want an experience of fire and earth, go out on a hot summer day onto the beach and stick your toes in the sand. That's fire and earth. Sand, hot sand. That's what that feels like. It's dry. It's dryness. Dryness is what we feel when fire and earth are put together. And now we're on third base on earth. What happens if we go down to home plate again, which is water? As we go from earth into water, what is the sensation of earth and water together? Well, you know what that feels like. It's called cold. Cold. It's the cold earth of a winter day, if you will. It's earth and water together gives you the sensation of cold. So these are how external, the out there world, creates the in-her world of sensations. The out-there world of objective qualities, when combined, creates the in-here world of sensations. And, for example, how would we change something which was dry into something which was moist? How would we do that? In order to go from dry to moisture, we would have to somehow get the fire element out and get the water element in. And not only that, we'd have to get the earth element out and get the air element in. So there would be two transformative processes to change something from dry to moist. So let's start off by figuring out how do we change something dry into something cold. So we are going from earth and fire into earth and water. We have to change, transform the fire into the water. And if that takes place, if that transformation takes place, then something which is dry will become something which is cold. So that's simply to do. I mean, if you have something which is earth and fire together, you put out the fire, and now suddenly you have something which is cold. Well, not only do you have something which is cold by doing so, but you're actually changing one element into another. Because when you change one element into another, when you take out the fire or take out the water or take out one of the elements and put in its reverse, you actually have a chemical change, a transformation which occurs. And that is the kind of thing that the alchemists were very much into. Well, there's another side to this whole story. Not only do we have the Greek objective baseball triangle that I just told you about, we also have an internal subjective triangle. So draw the same triangle that we just drew for the earth, air, fire, and water. And this time, we're going to put at the home plate, we're going to put the word feeling. At first base, we're going to write the word sensation. At second base, we're going to write the word thinking. And at third base, we're going to write the word intuiting. Let's make those all ing words. Home plate is feeling. First base is sensing. Second base is thinking. Third base is intuiting. All right. Now, if we know those are the four elements, and now these are all subjective elements, what is it that comes about along the base paths? In other words, between feeling and sensing, between home plate and first base, what is the experience which would be a combination of feeling and sensing? What would that be like? And the answer is, we would experience that as objective energy. So when you're feeling and sensing together, that is, your senses are operating, you're, you know, that means you're smelling, hearing, tasting, seeing, whatever. When your senses are operating and you're feeling, and you're having feelings about that, that combination would be called energy. That's what you would experience as energy. That's what we mean when we say the word energy. We mean we're feeling and sensing. In fact, in a lot of spiritual disciplines, in a lot of traditions right now, the word energy is used almost primarily for describing anything from the sexual feelings you have when you get aroused to the feelings you get when you're doing a yoga posture, anything like that. These all involve feeling and sensing. Okay, now what about when you go from first base to second base? There we're going from sensing to thinking. What's involved in thinking and sensing? What is it that we experience of the out there world as a result of that? What we experience is space. Space, the final frontier, that out there stuff that we say is a space between. That comes about through the thinking and sensing function. Feelings aren't involved in experiencing space, but thinking is involved in experiencing space. What I'm saying is that if you're not thinking, you don't know what space is. You can't even experience it. Something's further from something else. Everything would be immediate. And there are many experiments that were done using the drug ketamine, which actually diminishes the sense of three-dimensional space to two-dimensional space, or in which the brain, which makes two-dimensional space into three-dimensional space, because your eyes are seeing two-dimensional images, when that is taken out, you don't experience space. Everything seems flat and Picasso painting-like. Okay. Now what happens when we go from second base, which is thinking, to third base, which is intuiting? What's involved when thinking and intuiting are brought together? What's involved there may surprise you, but what it is time. We are creating our experience of time when thinking and intuiting are brought together. It's our temporal sense. That's what we do when we say one thing happened after another. When we say, that was yesterday, this is today, oh, that's what I'm going to do tomorrow. That's involving your intuition and your mind, your thinking mind. So thinking and intuition gives us the experience of time, the whole temporal experience. Wipe out the thought and only have the intuition, and that would vanish. Wipe out the intuition and only have the thought, and you are be in a realm of pure no space, no time. Now, what happens when we go from third base, which is intuiting, to home plate, which is feeling? What's involved in the combination of those two subjective qualities, intuiting and feeling? And the answer there is movement. We experience movement. Either we see it as moving out there, or we experience our own movements. And it can be anything moving. But that is what happens when intuition and feeling are involved. Now, these are the primary lessons that we get from understanding the alchemy, the new alchemy of the transformation of mind into matter. In the next session, session 10, we're going to be looking at the living experiences of all that. We're going to be looking at how we transform the matter that we've just created into feeling. See you next time.
This concludes Session 9. Our program continues with Session 10, Matter into Feeling, with Fred Allen Wolfe.
All right, now we have looked at how mind transforms into matter in this new alchemical way of seeing, or this quantum physical way of seeing, because really the quantum physical way, as we are introducing it here, and the new alchemical way are really saying the same thing. There's a process. It was a 9-step process, but nevertheless, it made the first hunk of matter, the first cellular tissue. It is how the living experience of a physical entity comes into being. Now, so what? Now we got matter. What are we going to do with it? Well, we have got to allow it to feel. And by feeling, I mean the whole kit and caboodle of all of the experiences that a living being can have. Feeling is the basis of it all. It's the closest to vibration. It's really what makes life worthwhile. It's what we do when we are feeling each other out, when we're sensing things using our feelings, when we're thinking things, when we're intuiting. Feeling is the base operation of all that. It's the home plate of all of that basic structure. So, in order to understand all that and how feelings arise, let's look at something which we've just created, namely the cell, which just has arisen from the first 9 principles, or the cellular structures of which we are made of. Once you made one cell, you got them all. I mean, we made of billions of them. Once we made billions of cells, we got them all. Then we got beings come into being, and this is how it works. So let's now start with, wait a minute. How does this being, this conglomeration of cells, this configuration of all this stuff, how does it know that it is a thing? How does it recognize itself? How does it have self-awareness? Where does that come from? Well, now we're looking at the very first process in the transformative process of matter into feeling. It's the structurization or the formation of an I. Your I-ness, your highness. It's that coming into being. It's that I-ness we want to look at. How does that come into being? And what it seems to be is the following. What seems to happen is that in the act of limiting that which was unlimited, a self-reflection begins to occur, and something that gets limited, whatever it is that's been limited, begins to bounce around inside. It's called capturing the wave, collapsing the wave. We can think about it different ways. We can think of it as a popping the balloon. Whatever it is, we're actually taking something which is big and making something small. That whole process of collapse is what we're talking about. That process is what goes on when we begin to egoize, when we begin to make an ego, when we begin to make a differentiation of the out there from the in here. It's that process of bait, but now it's the process taking place in the human body. And what that involves is the symbol of the Aleph in physical existence, which in Hebrew is the 10th symbol, and it's the letter Yud. Yud. And Yud is like our English Y. It represents that symbol of the self in existence. It's the where what was possible becomes actual. So that's the symbol of this. The Aleph into the Yud is the formation of the beginning of an ego structure. Now, there's a problem with forming an ego structure. Namely, that whenever you limit something, you do get a limitation, you do get a cutting off, you do get a boundary condition set in, but you don't exactly reproduce what it was you were limiting. You produce a limited vision of what was what you were limiting. So in other words, whatever the bigger picture was, your smaller picture is not going to be quite the same as the bigger picture. We can understand that intuitively. There's a model we have in physics called the hologram, and you've often heard it said that any piece of a hologram contains it all. But actually, it does, but only in a very kind of a poor way. I mean, you can see what was captured by the whole hologram and a small piece of the whole hologram, but it's a very dim picture of whatever was captured. If you had the whole hologram, all the pieces assembled together, you'd get a much better picture. So that's what we're saying here. There is a limitation, and as a result, there's a kind of a befuddlement which arises, or if you will, a distortion of what arises. And this is exactly what our friend Plato was talking about when he said, when the soul gets encapsulated in a body, it becomes befuddled and confused, because it's now having the sense in a finite way. So that's the problem. An ego is formed, it creates a structure, it limits, and by creating a structure, by the way, something's coming up that we'll find out in a little while, but we're actually creating memory, because we're actually creating a replication of what was out there before it got limited. And as a result of that, we're gaining the ability to think about what's coming next, what happened before, what's out there, what's in here, through thought coming into the limited vibrational patterns that have been created. We're beginning to sense and experience a differentiation, a sense of objectivity, a sense of subjectivity, a sense of old, a sense of new. We're doing all that. And that may be wonderful when you're just a little kid and you're learning how to walk and you're learning not to fill your pants and you're learning not to dribble the food out and snort all the food out your nose when your mama's giving you a bottle. It's wonderful when you're learning how to control things. It's just absolutely what you want to do. But after a while, it's a limitation, because you learn, if that's all you learn, you get stuck in it. If you get stuck, for example, in only getting milk from a nipple, well, it's going to be a little bit strange when you go into a restaurant and you say, oh, the malted milk, but I need it in a baby bottle with a nipple on it. I mean, people are going to look at you, right? Well, you don't want to be stuck in every pattern you learn when you were a little kid, do you? So you got to learn how to let go of some stuff. You have to learn how to let go of egoic structures which limit the possibilities and begin to let them expand. And that process is probably scary for most of us. You're going to do it when you die, no matter whether you want to or not. You're going to do it. You're going to let go. And if you can learn to let go now, it's much easier to grab on to something new when you let go of what you're holding on to. If you're holding on to the branch, you can't grab on to the bigger sky hook which is coming down to save you as you hang on a cliff. If you don't let go of the branch, you don't get the sky hook. You got to let go of one to get the other. And it's that letting go which really gets us. But that process is actually a return from self into soul. It's the return from the confined self into the bigger self, if you will. And that's essentially all the game of Aleph and Yud. It's that game that they play, the game between spirit and existence. It is what is called the war with time that we are all engaged in. Let me briefly go through the next eight, and then I'm going to take you through some experiences of some of the transformation when we're dealing with matter into feeling. The second transformative process involving matter into feeling is dreams changing into reality. Now we're going from Beit, number 2, into 20, number 20, which is Kaf. Kaf is a symbol for the palm of the hand. It's the holding of something. But I see it as the transformative process which takes dream into reality. It's that experience of the seeing into the future, transforming and changing the process. It's what I really talked about already in the first change that I just talked about before this, but now it's more directly into stuff of the mind coming into stuff of the real world. The third one is the transformation from Gimel into what is called Lamed. Lamed meant in ancient Hebrew a walking stick. So it's the transformation from the symbol of movement into the actual motion of movement. It's here where we're going to come back in a little while and look at the wave of feeling and how all of that works, how you can actually use these principles to change situations in your everyday life. So we'll come back to that a little later. The fourth is the transformation from, remember, four was Dalit. It had meant resistance. We're transforming that into the number 40. You see, what we're doing now is we're going from 1 through 9. We now go from 10 through 90. So 10, 20, 30. Now we're at 40. And the symbol for number 40 is actually one which is very mysterious. It's a resistance, like 4, which is a resistance. But what it represents is water itself, because it's the letter Mem. And Mayim is the Hebrew word for water. So Mem is a symbol for water itself. And it is a symbol for memory as well. So what we're learning here is that in order to have memory, you got to have water. Now, that's Kabbalistically speaking. What about neurophysiologically speaking? Well, the body, we know, is roughly 65 to 67% water. But the brain is 85% water. Whoa, doody-loody, woo-woo-woo-woo. 85% water. So without water, you couldn't even have you wouldn't have a brain. You'd have just a bunch of tissue. I don't know what you would even use that for. But the water is what really makes the brain work. So water is very necessary to have a memory, to have a brain. So what we're dealing with here is this memory. But memory, remember we talked about that. When you limit something, you get a facsimile. And facsimiles are not originals. The ideal and the copy are not exactly the same. So what we're seeing here is copying. And when there's copying, there's possibility for error. And when there's error, there's possibilities for tomfoolery. There is the trickster, which can arise in the brain. And if we don't recognize the trickster and we believe what our memories tell us, we get stuck in the goo of absoluteness. And it is absolutely horrible to be stuck in the goo of absoluteness. Let me tell you a little story here. Yogi Berra was, you know, a great catcher. But as you probably all know, he was also a good storyteller. And he had these wonderful, crazy ideas, combining of words. And they were just kind of funny. Like, for example, he wrote a book. If you see a fork on the road, take it. That was one of his, you know, what does he mean? It's almost like quantum physics. See a fork on the road, take it. It means go on both roads at the same time. I mean, what do you mean by take it? Well, he was having a discussion one day with a bunch of umpires. And the umpires were talking about, you know, how they call games. And each umpire's got a different personality and, you know, different ways of looking at reality. And they were going to get Yogi involved. Well, what would you do, Yogi, if you were an umpire? How would you call a game? And he says, well, okay, I'll think about that, he says to these guys. And the first ump says, well, listen, let me tell you something. When I call a game, okay, I calls them as they are. If it's a strike, I call it a strike. If it's a ball, I call it a ball. I call them as they are. And he goes, whoa, this guy really sees reality out there. You know, that's the way they are. I don't know what would happen if he made an error. He'd probably feel terrible about himself. He calls them as they are. I mean, it's reality, right? The second umpire kind of, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge to Yogi and says, you know, I tell you, I understand, you know, sometimes can make an error. He says, I calls them as I seize them. I mean, you know, I may sometimes call a ball a strike a ball, but, you know, that's how I seize it. And, you know, I can make errors. I calls them as I seize them. And, you know, the first umpire is now looking a little sheepish, and they're all looking now towards what Yogi's going to say. And he looks at them and he says, they ain't nothing till I calls them. They ain't nothing till I calls them. Yogi is pointing out that nothing is anything until there's a subjective element introduced. Yogis are trickster in our memory, the trickster to remind us that we're the guys that call in the shots, and it's up to us. And we can, of course, make mistakes, as the second umpire said, but we don't want to get stuck in the first umpire's shoes, because then we're stuck in them's good, them's bad. I'm right, you're wrong. And every situation you come to, we meet characters like that in our lives, and they're boring, boring, boring. In fact, you didn't want to hang out with these guys because they never give in, right? Right. And if you're working for somebody like that, boy, not only boring, but, you know, you may never get a raise because, you know, he knows what you did wrong, and you're wrong, and that's it, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So, actually, that's the symbol of resistance in the brain, water in the brain, the trickster in the memory. The fifth symbol has to do with life in the living process. I call it the curve of life. It's where all the possibilities which can arise begin to form a matrix of possibilities for you so that you can modify the curve of your life and so that you can do things a little better, a little worse, you can improve. It allows for that sort of thing to take place. Oh, by the way, the symbol for that fifth experience of life is the Hebrew letter nun. And nun actually is the Hebrew word for fish, and it represents a living being. So the transformation from hay, which is the symbolic seed-like element of life, into the actual living element is called nun. Now we get to the sixth, which is number 60, by the way. We're getting into the symbol for, remember, Vav 6 was seed-like sexuality, the beginning, and male seed-like energies all spreading out like sperm cells. In 60, we have the evolution of that. It's the Hebrew letter Samech, and it represents the female quality of sexuality. So here we see that, as the Kabbalists rightfully knew, the female is more developed than the male. And guys, I mean, think about it. Women are far more complicated than we are. I mean, you know, they are. I mean, even their whole sexual apparatus is far more complicated than what we have going. I mean, you know, they got a finite number of eggs that can be people. I mean, just think. I mean, in a single male ejaculation, I mean, we've probably ejaculated more seed-like egg cells than a billion women may produce in a lifetime. But yet, these are very precious egg-like qualities that the female produces. And yet, the uterine structure, the whole structure of the female sex quality is very different from the male, and it is a higher evolution, according to Kabbalah. It's number 60. And because it deals with the completion of 6 and 60, which is male and female together, it implies something about the creation of the future. And it also gives us a message here. And this is a new kind of a message. You're not going to hear this from many before. It says what sex is really all about. Oh, I know what it's all about. It's selling cars. Oh, I know what it's all about. It's getting an erection. Oh, I know what it's all about. It's sexiness. It's nudge, nudge, wink, wink. I want that girl next to me. Or, oh, I hope he'll marry me. It's that kind of, no, Matilda, that's not what it's all about. Sex is really listening to voices from the future. Do, 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 do. Where are we? What is he talking about? Voices from the, what can that mean? What I mean is that when you're in the act of sex and you are doing this, you are experiencing the future calling to you. It's the voice of future possibilities, future, if you want, babies that might come into existence. Because that really is why sex is as pleasurable, or not, however you feel it, as it is to you, because that is what it is. Now, we've done a lot to get rid of that. We've done everything we can to try to cut that off by using all kinds of contraception. And I'm not saying you should or you shouldn't do any of that. I like sex too. All I'm trying to tell you is what it is. What you do with it is your business. I'm just telling you how it appears from a Kabbalistic point of view, from a matter into feeling point of view. The seventh transformation has to do, remember, with Zain, that's number seven, into 70, which is the Hebrew word Ayin, A-Y-N. And Ayin means eye in Hebrew. So what we're looking at here is the probable, the seeing of the probable, the arising of the probable, the vision of the universe. So from Zain, which is all the possibilities which could arise at the seed-like level, when we get to Ayin, there are the probabilities that we see in our everyday life. The eighth transformation from number 8 to number 80 was a transformation from Het into the symbol Fe. And Fe means the face of something. And this is the beginning of the face of something. It's the transformation, the gathering together of the seed-like possibilities, which have now, number 8, have been transformed into number 80. When we're getting this, we're beginning to form a face on the world. We're beginning to form, we're having a persona, a face, an encapsulation of soul, a sense of who and what we are. We're having a self come into being. And now when we go to the ninth symbol, which is the last one I'll talk about here, this is the transformation from Tet, number 9, to number 90, which is Sade. And Sade is the principle of female beauty. It's no wonder that we all appreciate feminine beauty. Feminine and beauty are really synonymous from the Kabbalistic point of view, highly structured, very evolved, and Sade is the most complex of all the Hebrew letters in the Aleph Beit, and it's the most interesting in terms of what it spells out. When you actually spell out the word Sade, because Hebrew letters are also Hebrew words, so Sade is spelled with three letters, Sade, Dalet, and Yud. And when you spell out Dalet, Dalet Lamatav, and Yud, Yov Yad Dalet, and you spell them all out, you can see a rain of infinite numbers of letters appearing on your page as you spell all these letters out and write them down. And what you begin seeing is how the universe gets constructed from the point of view of something which is hidden in it, but nevertheless very much there. There's a hidden element of love that's contained in Sade. And if you do some of this construction yourself, you'll actually be able to see it. And you can also find it, by the way, in my book, Matter into Feeling. Okay, well, just as we did in the previous session, I thought it'd be useful to look at the movement aspect of it all, because that's really the heart of transformation, is movement, change from one thing to another. And here we're talking now about number 30, which is the transformation from the symbol Gimel, number 3, into the symbol Lamed, number 30. And we're really talking now about something we call the wave of feeling. And now I want you to remember back to the baseball diamond that I originally drew for you in the previous session. Remember, home plate is feeling. First base, sensing. Second base, thinking. And third base, intuiting. And remember that on the baseline between home plate and first base, we have feeling and sensing. That's the experience of energy. Between first base and second base, between sensing and thinking, we have along that baseline the experience of space. Between thinking and intuiting, between second base and third base, we have the experience of time. And finally, between intuiting and feeling, that is between third base and home, we have the experience of motion itself. So now let's look at some of the transformative possibilities that result when you begin to realize that these are the elements of your whole living process, and that you are capable of changing one thing to another. And watch and see when you do what happens to that external world out there. This is really the secret of magic. This is how you can become a magician in the universe. Okay, so what we're dealing with here is what I call subjective transformation. Okay, so now we see how an intuition gets changed into a feeling by changing our sense of time into a sense of energy. But what about changing a feeling into an intuition? Changing from feeling about things to intuiting about things. What do we have to do there? We have to change, transform energy into time consideration. And I'll tell you how we're going to do that in a little, in just a moment. And what about the next part? Suppose you want to change intuiting into thinking. We're intuiting and now we want to get some thoughts out of all that. What do we have to change there? We have to change our experience of movement into space. We have to see things that are moving laid out into space. It's sort of like going from movement into standing still. And if we want to go the reverse way, which means changing thinking into intuition, we have to change space into motion. We have to bring things into motion. We have to let things move, and then whatever we thought becomes intuitive to us. All right, now let's look at some examples of this. Let's change an intuition into a feeling. What is an example of how that might work? Well, one of my favorite examples of this is a football game. There is a quarterback, and he is intuiting that one of his receivers will be free on the next play. He may have gotten this intuition based upon something he saw in the previous play. I don't know how he got the intuition, but he has the intuition that, you know, that wide receiver is going to be free, or it may be a tight end is going to be free. Okay, so now he sees in his mind, he runs the sequence of time in his mind as to how this receiver is going to get free. He knows in which direction he's going to throw the ball and when. He does this all by intuiting. He doesn't really think about it. He's just, it's going on in his mind, yes, but he's seeing the picture. He's not thinking, he's going to go off 3 steps and turn to the left. I'm going to wait 3 seconds and throw it to the right. Blah, 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 blah. He's not doing all that. He's seeing the picture. This is what intuition is. It's seeing the picture, like watching a motion picture in your mind. That's what he's doing. He's seeing it going on. He's seeing the play. Now, the play actually starts. He's done intuiting, and now he's called the play, and now it's going to start. Now what does he do? When he begins the play, he's now transforming this intuition, this picture, into energy. Now he's got to really, you know, throw the ball. It's enough that he's got the whole sequence laid out in time in his mind in a picture. Now he's got to move that into his arm. And if he doesn't do that, that ball ain't going anywhere. So now he transforms that from temporal consideration into energetic consideration. How hard do I throw the ball? What direction do I throw the ball? Energy is now involved. This is the transformation from time into energy. And when he does that, he gets the feeling going on in his whole body. Not just a sensation, but he feels it. He evaluates it. He knows just how hard to throw that ball, how high to throw that ball. That's his transformative process, intuition into feeling. Anytime you transform an intuitive notion into a feeling notion, that's what goes on. It doesn't involve thought. It only involves intuiting and feeling, and it's the kind of thing you have to do if you are a leader of any type of situation at all, because you've got to bring things into action, and that's how that is done. Okay, as another example, let's now look at changing thinking into intuiting. Wow, that's a different switch, isn't it? How will we do that? How will we change what we're thinking about into something we're intuiting about? Well, thought allows us to lay out a plan of action. It allows us to see the steps we have to take. So if, as we put a plan, a thought into action, meaning we allow motion to take place, intuition about the course and direction of the plan continues to arise. So let's see how that all works. This time we're going to go to an example that I think all you ladies out there will understand. It's called dancing. So we're going to look at how that takes place. What is it that we have to do as we're going to change a thought into an intuition? What we have to do is change space into motion. We've got to go from our fixed positions of our plan into seeing it in action in movement. It's actually in movement. It's movement back and forth. It's that which takes place in a dance. So here's how it goes. While learning the new choreography, what you're looking at is, okay, put your right foot out, put your left foot in, then you do a but, and you do the body dot, and then you put your left foot in the dot, dot, and then you do it, and da 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 da. And you got that going on in your head. You may even listen to the tune, but you're seeing how your feet go, your right foot, then your left foot, and then you turn, and you go this way, then you go that way. You're seeing it in your head. That's the thinking process, okay? Now you begin to do it. When you're doing it, now you're totally into intuition. You're into time and motion. You're doing it. You're in time, but you're moving. You're not even thinking about it anymore. You know, I mean, whenever I first learned a dance step, I have to, and my partner's trying to teach me, she's showing me how to do this new step. And oh my God, I mean, the right foot, then the left foot, and I'm trying to, and I'm practically tripping myself trying to learn this dance step. And she's just doing it naturally because she's not thinking about it. She's not thinking about it. She's just doing it, right? I remember when I first learned how to bowl. And one of my father's friends who was watching me, I was always known to be kind of a, you know, glass-wearing intellectual type of guy, right? So my father's friend was watching me bowl. And, you know, I was throwing gutter balls and all. He says, Fred, he says, stop thinking about it. Just throw the ball. Don't think about it so much. Just throw it. And that was a secret. That's the changing of thought into intuition. So as she realizes her steps, she may start doing this intuitive dance and she sees, something's wrong. Well, then she's got to go back and change her intuition, her wrong steps, into thought. No, right foot goes to the left this time, not to the right. Okay. Now she begins again. So now she's doing a process which involves transforming back and forth between intuiting and thinking. What about changing thinking into sensing? How do we do that? Well, thought really involves time and sensation involves energy. So what you're doing is you're changing temporal or time consideration into energy consideration. Now, how will we do that? Well, surprisingly, this may surprise you, you do that in a wine tasting. Wait a minute. How does that work? Well, since thought always involves time, for example, you are about to taste some wine, okay? A wine taster thinks about the wine. Oh, you don't think so? Well, if they didn't think about the wine, where would they come up with such things as, it has a very, very good nose? What do you mean it has a good nose? Because I can smell it. Oh, I see. And it has a slightly chocolatey, like chocolate flavor. What do you mean it has a chocolate flavor? Because I can taste it. But he's using words. He's using thoughts to describe the wine. In fact, you read all about the wine, and it has the aroma of crushed athletic sock together with chocolate-covered cafe. And you, oh my God, I don't want to drink that. That sounds horrible to me. Who wants to eat an old athletic sock? These are the kinds of words that he used to describe how the wine is going to taste. They're words. They're thoughts. They're in time. They have nothing to do with the taste of the wine. But yet, if we've tasted wines before, we might imagine from that what the wine might taste like. But now we have to change that. We got to go from time into energy. We actually have to taste the darn wine. We got to see what it really tastes like. And when we do that, when we have energy, we're now moving ourselves into sensation, and now time has been changed into energy, and now the sensation is taking place in the space of the mouth, and the energy of that transformative process is what gets your taste buds going, ooh, it is like an athletic sock, ooh, that smells, ooh, that tastes like crushed berries, ooh, that is chocolatey, oh, that's not very chocolatey, that's maybe white chocolatey, and whatever. That is in the thoughts that now come back to you from the sensations in your mouth as you begin the transformative process, which takes you into sensation, back into thought, into sensation, back into thought. What you're actually doing is transforming your experience of time and energy back and forth, back and forth. Now, as you begin to play with this new alchemy, this magic, you can begin to watch yourself as you engage with, say, listening to experiencing another person. How do you do that? Here comes this delicious babe. How am I going to experience her? Well, maybe you smell her first. Or maybe you look at her first. You get a sensation of her first. Or maybe you listen to her first. Ah, I love the melodious tones of her voice. Or maybe none of those things. Maybe it has nothing to do with the sensations you have of her. Maybe you just get an intuitive picture of her. You see her in your mind as she dances or as she moves, and you have no sensation of her at all. She's like an image, a chimera, a mystical movement, a flowing of things. I've got to tell you something. When I first fall in love with women, I always go into that stage first. I go to the mystical. I see them in motion. It's not how they smell, how they taste, how big their bazookas are. It has nothing to do with any of that stuff. It has to do with how they are in motion, their intuition, the movement of them, the magic of it. That's what gets me. That's where I go, oh, boy, and that's when I fall. And other men are different. Bazookas are important. Smell is important. What they say is important. Maybe what they don't say is important. Whatever it is, they're into sensation. They're sensation-oriented. I'm more into the intuitive. So you can see that everybody's different. But by transforming one thing into another, I can see the same woman in a different light. And in fact, as I get to know somebody, that's exactly what I do. I don't always look at them the same way. I transform my space aspect of them into motion, or I transform the motive aspect of them into space. I see them in space. I transform the energetic aspect of them into the temporal aspect, into more of the thinking aspect. These are the things you can do. These are the processes you can go through. This is what's called new alchemy, and this is what's involved in the transformation of matter into feeling. So we're now ready to go even farther as we go into session 11.
This concludes session 10 of Dr. Quantum Presents, A User's Guide to Your Universe with Fred Allen Wolf. Our program continues with session 11.